I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and now former Democratic Congressman Eric Massa of New York seems intent on sharing, and he'll do more of it today with CNN's Larry King and Fox's Glenn Beck. Massa has officially resigned his House seat. Originally, he said the reason was poor health. Now he's saying he was forced out because he's against health care reform because it lacks the public option. And he says charges, including that he'd sexually harassed a male staffer at a wedding, are a scheme. He points to a heated exchange with White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel in the House locker room as proof.
I'm sitting there showering, naked as a jaybird, and here comes Rahm Emanuel, not even with a towel wrapped around his tush, poking his finger in my chest, yelling at me because I wasn't going to vote for the president's budget. Do you know how awkward it is to have a political argument with a naked man?
Well, no. That comment came during Massa's weekly radio broadcast on WPKQ in New York. I guess naked men in the locker room and a Mamma Mia wedding dust-up were the only things left in the health care debate. But will this chapter impact reform? Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News, author of The Note on abcnews.com. Rick, your thoughts?
It is bizarre, and it gets weirder and weirder. I mean, if you listen to the entirety of his 90-minute radio interview from over the weekend in upstate New York, it's rambling, it's contradictory, there's conspiracy theories in there, and clearly this is a guy that's not going to go away. You have a Democratic congressman making very serious allegations, most without any kind of substantiation, most without any kind of an independent verification, most, frankly, hard to believe. But he's out there, and he's going to own another news cycle as a result of it.
Well, and we will link to his radio broadcast at hereandnow.org. But just take us through some of these stories. Start with the New Year's Eve wedding.
Well, Massa is married. He was actually at the wedding with his wife, but there with several staffers saying that he had about 15 gins and tonics. He had been dancing with one of the bridesmaids and was encouraged by one of his staff members to try to hook up with the bridesmaid. And he turned to the staff member, a male staff member, and said, well, maybe I should be fracking you. And some kind of a euphemistic expression there. And then he said he headed up to bed, knowing that he had made a mistake that that he would later apologize for.
Well, that staff member was his former deputy chief of staff, Ron Hickel. Did he make the ethics charge?
That's right. It actually came to the attention of staff members for the House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, who said, you have to take this to the Ethics Committee or I will. And subsequently, it was referred to the Ethics Committee. But again, Congressman Massa made no reference to this in his original statement last week. He had said it was health reasons. Then he referenced this, and then came the long ramblings from over the weekend.
Well, and Hoyer says that he talked to Massa about this. Massa says he did not. He says all these inquiries are a conspiracy to get him out of the House, as we heard. But in terms of Rahm Emanuel, who Massa said is the son of the devil's spawn, and Massa has said he has very salty language, but his accusations about Emanuel come when Emanuel, you know, is seen as being vulnerable, as someone that President Obama has not been listening to when maybe he should have been.
Rahm has very strong relationships on Capitol Hill. He's involved in trying to get those last votes on health care reform. It is a time, as you mentioned, people are out for scalps these days. They're looking for scapegoats. So I think it's a difficult storyline for the chief of staff, White House chief of staff, to be dealing with, even though, as we say, there's really no backup for these allegations that he's making, these kind of wacky things that he is saying he was engaged in. But we're at a time where it's just so delicate. Every vote does count, and it's going to be so difficult to get to that magic number of now 216 in the House. The last thing the White House needs is another day of distraction.
Well, what is the truth about whether or not it mattered if Massa's seat is vacant, which it now is, when it comes to a vote on health care?
In a weird way, Democrats lost a seat, but they gained a vote on health care because the membership of the House went down one. The magic number to pass something went down one as well. He was going to be a no on health care. Democratic leadership knew that. So there is a side benefit. But I should note in all of this, nobody technically forced him out. He resigned of his own volition. He could have rescinded that resignation letter even after he sent it on Friday. If he wanted to stay and fight this out, he knew this was being investigated by the Ethics Committee. He could have stayed, and if he wanted to really annoy the so-called devil spawn, he could have stayed and voted against health care and made it more difficult on Nancy Pelosi and the White House. He decided to get out of the way. There was no indication that he was forced in any way.
Well, and there are other allegations that are surfacing against Massa, including a 1991 incident, which he admits. And again, he speaks about this on the audio link we have at our website, but basically he was on a Navy ship and walked in on a shipmate in a compromising position and made an inappropriate comment. So Rahm Emanuel and Nancy Pelosi could actually come out looking better if, in fact, they recognize that they perhaps had something of a loose cannon. But then it's odd because it's a Democrat from the left who wanted the public option.
Yeah, there's nothing easy about the politics around all of this. You're right. They got rid of someone if they didn't get indeed get rid of him, coming at it from the left who's going to vote no like Dennis Kucinich is, the argument Democrats are going to make is that, yes, when they've had problems, they've dealt with them. And whether that's Charlie Rangel stepping down from Ways and Means or Eric Massa resigning in the face of an ethics inquiry, they say that's a difference from Republicans who tried to fight it out and take the case to voters that it's something to hang their hats on, at least as they go forward. But so much of this is just going to depend on the overall landscape and whether they can get health care done or not.
Well, and what will the right or Republicans make of this story? We mentioned Massa's going to be on Glenn Beck's talk show, and those are strange bedfellows, both against health reform, but for very different reasons. Will Massa still be held up by the right?
I think they actually know what he stands for. They will, though, likely just glom on to the accusations, the allegations that he's making against Rahm Emanuel and the White House and House leadership and jump on that and say, this is coming from a liberal Democrat. It gives it a little bit more weight. I don't think this is something that has House Democrats in general running for the hills. They see him as a loose cannon who speaks for himself and is now gone. But, again, it is a distraction at a tough time.
Rick Klein of ABC.com's The Note on the resignation of New York Congressman Eric Massa amid ethics allegations. And what's next? Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Senate takes a key test vote on extending unemployment insurance today. Democrats need to muster at least one Republican vote to move the legislation forward, which might be tough. Extending unemployment benefits through December could cost an additional $66 billion. The bill could have legs, though, because it does contain about 60 popular tax breaks for businesses and individuals. But it doesn't include new ideas for creating jobs. It just reprises many elements from last year's $800 billion stimulus bill. Many small business owners say they're not impressed with any jobs plans they've heard coming out of Washington. So what do small businesses need to hear? Here now is Meghna Chakrabarty, visited two small manufacturers in central Massachusetts to find out.
Over there you'll see the picture of a John Deere combine. We have a lot of parts that go into the combine.
And not just in combines or farm tractors. John Stowe says his company, Lutco Incorporated, makes specialized metal parts for trucks, lawnmowers, snowblowers, ATVs, even garage doors. Chances are you've used a part made in his Worcester, Massachusetts factory, but probably didn't know it. His factory floor is 30,000 square feet, and as we walk through it, past elephant-sized green metal stamping machines, and around spools of steel 5 feet wide, Stowe warns me not to be fooled by all the activity. Lutco isn't as busy as he'd like.
So how many people do you have working here in the manufacturing area?
In here we probably have 60 or 70 people.
And is it a 24-hour day operation?
No, not now. It used to be two shifts. We're down to one shift now.
One 8 or 10-hour shift?
One eight-hour shift.
Okay.
I know manufacturing or production control would like to have that flexibility of having a second shift back. But until we see strong signs of economic recovery, it's just not necessary.
So. Well, even though I'd love to do the whole interview in here, it is kind of loud, so should we head back to your office?
And back in his office, I ask John Stowe what it would take for him to bump back up to two shifts or maybe even put new people to work.
If we saw a strong recovery occurring and the individuals in the country, the companies who are not in the process of deleveraging or trying to reduce debt, which they'll do first before they start to spend again and before they start to hire and increase their inventories, until we start seeing that, we don't expect a fast return to the high point of 08, which was our busiest year in our history.
John Stowe is at the end of a long causal chain. People don't have extra cash, so they're not buying new equipment. That means the John Deeres and Mack Trucks of the world are consequently cutting back. They don't need as many of those specialized metal parts, and that leaves Stowe with few orders to fill and fewer reasons to take on new employees. So here's the first hint about why some small business owners don't have much faith in government jobs plans. The way Stowe puts it, the receding tide of the recession foundered everyone. Tax cuts, credits, and better banking are nice, but those limited ideas are a little like hauling just one boat off the bottom. It's helpful, but without the economic tide rushing back in, that boat, that business is still high and dry.
And nobody seems to understand that piece of it.
This is Kate Putnam.
Bringing in somebody new is not automatically and immediately an incremental gain to me. They're not productive on their first or second day.
Putnam is president of Package Machinery Company in West Springfield, Massachusetts. It's another one of those companies you've probably never heard of, but you've almost certainly used what they make. Bought a box of tea or candy recently? The cellophane and foil that wraps the tea bags and the candy, that's what Package Machinery makes. Putnam has 6 employees. Last summer, she had 9. And even though her workforce is small, Putnam is a dominant player in the U.S. packaging market, with just 1 domestic competitor. Foreign makers are her bigger challenge, the ones that sell to huge American businesses like Kraft and Procter & Gamble. But Putnam has a hard time closing deals abroad.
The strong dollar for the last really 20 years has made it very, very difficult for manufacturers of all stripes. The reality is that if we can bring the dollar down, we can grow our exports. And that's probably a more important thing to be helping manufacturers do at this point than to be sort of saying, well, gee, go hire somebody.
And on top of that, Putnam feels completely alone when it comes to dealing with the rat's nest of regulations that come along with doing business overseas. A U.S. government Office of Small Business Export Support is what she really needs and what she really wants, but she's not hearing about that in any jobs plan. And that's the second reason why many small businesses aren't putting much stock in Washington's employment recipe. Putnam doesn't see any long-term thinking there. No one seems to be asking, yes, we've got to survive this recession, but how are we going to thrive in the next boom? Putnam says they're asking that question in Europe.
I can tell you what my competitors in Italy do. If you employ less than 50 people, the state will subsidize up to 3 years of on-the-job training, basically paying for an apprenticeship program. And that's probably the most important thing that I need, because the reality is that skilled blue-collar workers are a dying breed or a retiring breed, and I don't have replacements for them.
So, 2 small manufacturers, 2 critiques of Washington's job plans. John Stowe at Lutco Incorporated says the government needs to think in bigger terms about how to pull the entire economy up. Kate Putnam at Package Machinery believes lawmakers need to think long-term, too. This is, after all, unlike any recession we've seen in 80 years. So they both believe politicians need to think more creatively and not reach for the easy and rote policy instruments that sound bold but do little to help. Without that, Kate Putnam sees a long, lonely road ahead for American small manufacturers.
And that makes it hard to do anything with any certainty right now. It's kind of like you're standing on the ledge feeling your way along rather than being able to stride along.
That report from Here and Now's Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, what about some of the ideas we just heard from these small business owners? And is Washington overlooking them in the rush to bail out big business owners? Later, don't forget the story of 2 foreign correspondents who fell in love in Italy and returned there to recover from a sniper's bullet. That's later, but back after a break, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We just heard 2 owners of small manufacturing companies express their concerns about jobs and job creation. John Stowe said he feels the government needs to think in bigger terms. Kate Putnam said lawmakers need to think more long-term, with perhaps government subsidies for training increasingly hard to find skilled blue-collar workers. Well, Jeffrey Rosenzweig joins us now. He's professor of finance and international business and head of the Global Perspectives Program at Emory University. And Jeff, we're also hearing other reports, for instance, one recently in the Boston Globe about money from the stimulus package that radiated through the manufacturing industry in this corner of the world. A government contract was given to a company that makes airport security systems, that's Reveal Imaging, and from there, it trickled down and created scores of jobs across this region. So we have these 2 competing narratives. Which is more true?
I think the first one is true. You know, we could find anecdotes of companies that got stimulus, created jobs, and then there was the multiplier effect you spoke about. But we could also talk about thousands of businesses across our country that has closed down, or as your first interviewee said, is running one shift instead of two, or two shifts instead of three. Our manufacturing employment in the U.S. peaked more than 30 years ago, declined since then, and has been just loitered in this past decade.
Well, when the Obama administration first came out with its stimulus package, you said it was necessary, but you had some caveats, mostly to do with small businesses. So tell us, what do you think has gone wrong, given that are you still saying that the stimulus was a good idea?
Yes, I'm sorry, Robin. I think the stimulus as an overall concept was a good idea. I think it could have been spent much more intelligently. We really didn't spend it in ways that would create jobs. The Chinese, for instance, had a similar size stimulus, and they really did spend it on improving their infrastructure. And, of course, that did create even more manufacturing jobs if you're building bridges and things. And also now they have a better infrastructure. So as we economists look back, it's very hard to see what gains we got from the stimulus. I think we did get some. We avoided a second Great Depression, but it could have been spent a lot more intelligently.
So you agree with the other economists who say that it stopped the free fall, but it sounds like you're saying it could have done more to push the economy forward and create jobs, and it hadn't done that. So tell us some of the other ways that you think the money could have been more creatively spent.
Like I say, infrastructure is number one. Down here in Atlanta, for instance, we have an antiquated sewer system, which needs to be updated. We have a subway that doesn't go many places, so money could have really been targeted more at public transportation, which is, you know, either of those can create manufacturing jobs. And so there's things we could have done that would stimulate manufacturing. In other words, these are not service jobs, but they also make us competitive in the long run. You know, we spent $800 billion over these 2 years, and I'm not sure how they make us any more competitive vis-a-vis, for instance, Chinese manufacturing.
What about some of the other suggestions we heard from these manufacturers? One, to do as they do in Europe and subsidize small businesses to help them train blue-collar workers. Another is to help small businesses by helping them subsidize pay for workers if, in fact, they can't afford the minimum wage. Your thoughts?
The most important thing is to get people who are idled anyway into a productive workforce, building skills and also building an attachment to the labor force, to going to work every day. We may as well be getting people training and getting them working if right now they're just home getting depressed about it. And this is very important. I think it's a very good use of taxpayer money, because it helps people who, again, don't have the skills or are not yet viable in 21st century industry become viable. The second point is that I think we definitely needed the raises we've had in the minimum wage to move closer to a living wage. But it may mean that their unskilled people may not yet have the skills where they're worth that much wage to a manufacturer, especially in a tough economy. But again, the point is, in my mind, that they gain the skills. So I think as taxpayers, I think we should be willing to subsidize their wage so that the manufacturer doesn't have to pay more than the worker is worth to them. And these don't have to be long-term subsidies. It's just enough, maybe a year or two, until the people gain the skills that the manufacturer, it's in their own best interest to pay them a living wage, because they say, oh, now this person has the skills I need.
And Jeffrey Rosenzweig, again, professor of finance and international business and head of the Global Perspectives Program at Emory University in Atlanta, making these comparisons between U.S. and other policies. Just how much of the economy does small business fuel?
Small business fuels most of the economy. And more importantly, it fuels the job creation. All a listener has to do is think of just about any large business they can think of, and not just car companies or banks, even companies that are doing well like IBM, and just think back, and all they see are headlines, laying off 1,500, laying off 5,000, laying off 8,000. The jobs have been created by small business basically for decades. And interestingly, the majority of those are owned by women. Again, big businesses, as they strive for their form of efficiency, they're not the job creators. It's the woman that starts a small business, and if we can get credit flowing to her, she can move from 4 employees to 10. And if I notice one criticism as I travel the country giving speeches to business people, it's that President Obama seems to favor big government, big labor, but also big business. They think he's very happy favoring a Goldman Sachs or a large business. You know, I think President Obama has a lot of good intentions, but I think he will never win the support of people building businesses unless he overcomes this, just seems like a innate bias toward big.
Jeffrey Rosenzweig, again, as we said, of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Professor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
And by the way, we're aware that we just touched on some of the challenges small manufacturers face. We've covered things like freeing up credit and exporters who have to deal with the value-added tax. You can listen to those stories at our website, hereandnow.org. Tomorrow, once a cash-rich school district, Kansas City, Missouri is planning to close nearly half the schools. That's tomorrow. Latest news is next, here and now. Where have all the ski bums gone? It's a question that's being asked out west, where the construction jobs that kept many skiers afloat have dried up in the bad economy. But one place the ski bums are sure to surface is this weekend at the annual Dirtbag Ball that honors them. It's a big event in Montana. The Big Sky Resort Ski Patrol runs it officially to raise money for equipment and training, but really it's a day-long party complete with a dirtbag parade, wild costumes, and the crowning of the Dirtbag King and Queen. James Frisk is a longtime ski patrolman at Big Sky, known as Magnum on the slopes. James, define dirtbag. How do you know when you see one?
Oh, Robin, a dirtbag is usually spotted by their dark raccoon tans and duct tape on their rips on their coats and faded everything.
Well, largely because, you know, they work as these guys running lifts and gals running lifts, and they don't normally live, we understand, in Big Sky. They take buses in from Bozeman. Well, we look back at the history of Big Sky, and I did not know that the Big Sky Resort was founded by the late, great NBC News anchor Chet Huntley. And then sort of a community formed around it. And at this ball, a lot of people's thoughts go back to the 70s, we understand, with what they're wearing. So what do people wear?
You probably will never see that many people in drag in Montana at any one place at any given time. But various football helmets adorned with beer cans with hoses down to the mouth or deer antlers. Just wild costumes. It's a combination of Mardi Gras and Festival all in one.
And I'm reading old one-piece ski outfits, those, you know, Dayglo pink ones with shoulder pads.
Absolutely. The more retro, the better.
And we should say there's a lot of drinking involved. And, you know, given all the trouble Bodie Miller got in, this is not an event for kids.
It is not an event for kids, but we do try to keep things a little under control.
Well, and there's a Dirtbag Ball T-shirt this year. Can you describe it?
Well, on the front, it just says simply Dirtbag, and on the back it says fully equipped since 1979, I believe, although the Ski Patrol has been around since 73, has an avalanche transceiver, an avalanche probe, an avalanche shovel, and a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer.
Well, so the first few things are serious, and that's what you're raising money for the Ski Patrol, and then the can of beer is the fun part. But tell us more about the culture there. We spoke with Big Sky post office worker Jean Palmer. You know her as Queen Jean. She was coronated the queen of the dirt ball, I understand, in 1999. She tells us she won because she skied more days than she worked.
That's basically the definition of royalty, is somebody who is there every day, regardless of the weather, regardless of conditions, regardless of their condition, that people that just live to ski.
Well, and yet they have to have other work to help them do that. We understand that Big Sky is wrestling somewhat with what to be in the future, whether to incorporate and officially become a town. Right now there's no mayor, there's a chamber of commerce. Do you think if it becomes a town, it will affect this spirit?
I can't see things changing that much. It's basically run by homeowner associations. It was growing rapidly, but with the economy, everything has slowed down a lot. And I think Big Sky, regardless of what government it has, will basically remain the same.
But as it grows and as the homes get more expensive and the dirt baggers, I guess, get priced out more and more, can it maintain in that respect?
Oh, I think it always will. There's always employee housing, and people travel the canyon and live down canyon, and it's the same at all ski areas. They find a way to do it. They find a way to ski. Wait tables at night or 10 bar, wash dishes, work at the all-night gas station, you know, load lists in a day so they get a free pass.
Yeah. And live in their car sometimes?
If they have to. I do know one good friend of mine who is actually a famous extreme skier who travels about the West in his 4Runner with his dog.
Yeah. Well,
and lives in the free parking lot, by the way, not the pay parking lot.
Well, you've got your dirtbag ball coming up. What are some of the things you expect to see this weekend?
Gosh, only knows. Everybody and everybody tries that to each other, and they look forward to it all year. And you really should come and do this.
Only, James, if I can have a crown.
I guarantee you we'll get you a crown.
Okay. James Frisk, a 30-year veteran of the Big Sky Ski Patrol in Montana. They're coming up on their big dirtbag ball this weekend to raise money for their ski patrol, but also honor the ski bums. James, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Okay, just ahead. There was Sovietology when there was a Soviet Union. Should American colleges now train jihadologists? That's in about 30 seconds, here and now. Can a bunch of professors help the U.S. fight Islamic fundamentalism? Our next guest, David Engerman, says yes, pointing out in an essay in Foreign Affairs magazine online that it was a bunch of professors derided in some corners who helped the U.S. shape the policies toward the Soviet Union. It's hard to picture now, but the Soviet Union once loomed as an unknown and frightening enemy. In the late 40s, the field of studies called Sovietology was created jointly by leading universities and the U.S. government to generate knowledge and analysis about a deeply secret system and train both scholars and civil servants in the race to understand the threat the U.S. faced. It was tough. There was so much fear that sometimes the post office would confiscate copies of Pravda. David Engerman, associate professor of history at Brandeis University, is now calling for a new field of jihadology. He's the author of Know Your Enemy, The Rise and Fall of America's Soviet Experts. So, David, make your case. Don't we already have a lot of departments of Middle Eastern and Islamic studies here in the U.S.?
We do, but they're by and large divided within themselves. They're also quite distant, I think, from the kind of government work that made Sovietology work so well. And there's some very good reasons for it, the 60s being the largest, and this mistrust on both sides in the other. But I think what Sovietology did very well was this sort of middle range of work where they would understand questions that had direct policy relevance, but they were not writing policy briefs. So they wrote remarkably thorough and interesting books on slender reads of evidence at times, hard-won evidence, to study the nature of the Soviet political system. They invented a way of calculating the Soviet economy because the Soviets weren't very good at it themselves. They devoted all of this effort to produce things that were both meant to serve in a world of scholarship and to provide basic context. So they didn't answer the question, what is Khrushchev going to do next week? That's not a question for academics to answer.
They might instead, as Harvard did, have a program where they interviewed Soviet refugees.
They did. They produced 10,000 questionnaires and 1,000 interviews, all done for the U.S. Air Force, to understand the nature of Soviet society.
Today, the Army has the program called the Human Terrain System. You're familiar with that. Anthropologists joining soldiers in the field. Some anthropologists reject it because they say they can't afford to be viewed as soldiers. Once there's a gun, then they won't be trusted as anthropologists. It compromises their work. Some on the military side are worried about soldiers having to try to protect anthropologists, even though the idea is one that comes from Sovietology. Let's know more about the people. So again, it feels as if today it's much more complicated than it might have been then.
It's much more complicated, and for some very good reasons. I do think the early Sovietologists were quite innocent about the fluidity of going between academic life and government life. Most of them, I think, got that innocence during World War II, where they had switched back and forth and saw that one activity wasn't compromising another. But the Human Terrain System strikes me, or this Army program, is exactly the wrong way to do it. It's not just some anthropologists who are against it. The American Anthropological Association have released an official statement opposed to it, not least because three social scientists, they're not only anthropologists there, but three social scientists in the Human Terrain System have been killed. The more important point is it's just not helping scholars to help the Army do what it can do best. During World War II, there was the same concern about how to train people to serve in foreign countries. And the Army's response then was to create the Army's Specialized Training Program, ASTP, set up on dozens of college campuses and training thousands of soldiers. They trained them in language and culture. They didn't want one single consultant to go over there and serve on the front lines. They thought they used the scholars for what the scholars could be most useful for, I thought.
So tell us more about what you'd like to see.
Well, I think in terms of the government work, scholars need to stop rejecting, as some do, any form of government aid as inherently problematic. At the same time, I think government agencies, especially those tied to the Pentagon or national security, need to be aware of the political sensitivities that scholars feel about their work. I can mention one program that was set up by Sovietologists in the 1970s that gives a great example. The Defense Department set up, with the help of CIA funds eventually, what was called the National Council on Soviet and Eastern European Research, which still exists today under a slightly changed name. And I actually spoke with someone fairly senior in the Office of Secretary of Defense who applauded this program and said he learned a lot about the fate of the Soviet Union from reading about literary and cultural trends in the era. He said he had better intelligence about military affairs. But what he didn't know was the texture of the society and the culture, and this is what the program could provide. And it's this sort of thing that I think could provide a great model for government work that would encourage a deeper understanding of, however we're defining the threat, Islamic fundamentalism.
But what about the fact that some people feel Sovietology didn't work in the end run? Experts failed to predict the collapse of the Soviet Union that, as many Sovietologists now say, rather than the Soviet Union being pushed over by the U.S. weapons buildup, it actually imploded financially from within, and this was something that came as a surprise to U.S. Sovietologists.
It came as something of a surprise, but I think for the most part, hearing all the attacks that, on Sovietology for failing to predict the demise of the Soviet Union is really just the sound of political axes being sharpened. That scholars were well aware, if you look at literature, the writings in the 1980s, well aware of all the faults in the Soviet Union. They cataloged them in exquisite detail. They had a hard time predicting the timing, but we might forgive that by remembering that Gorbachev himself had a hard time predicting the timing, and he had access to more information and more power, and had more power than the Sovietologists did. So I wouldn't say that Sovietology was perfect. There were many mistakes it made over the years. But by and large, they had a pretty good handle on the Soviet Union in the 1980s. So I don't know that we can solve all the problems of knowing our enemies from this, but I do think there is a lot that we can find out. And that ways that scholars can be useful, that we can try and overcome some of the mistrust that emerged for understandable reasons in the 1960s, and to try and see ways in which we can work together. One example that would come to mind for me is that trying to understand where young jihadis come from. If you only study the people who become jihadis, you don't have a clear understanding of their social context. And so we need sociologies of youth in Islamic societies, for instance. We need to know better the economics and economic opportunities available to them. This doesn't answer the question of which individual person will become a jihadi or a suicide bomber, but it does help us understand and even perhaps predict the dangerous situations that will come in the future.
That's David Engerman, Associate Professor of History at Brandeis University, author of Know Your Enemy, The Rise and Fall of America's Soviet Experts. And by the way, David, just from your perch there at Brandeis, do you see students excited about a possible new field, jihadology? Do you see people responding to that?
I do see. Even Brandeis, which has, I would say, in general, a relatively liberal student body, I've talked to and written letters for a number of people who want to enter armed services and intelligence, and many of them are motivated by applying the things that they've learned about how to understand the world, the things that they've learned at Brandeis, into other settings, including classified and political ones.
David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
One often wonders what happens after a headline. Reporter Paula Buderini became the headline when she was beaten bloody by police while covering a protest during the Czech Velvet Revolution. Her fiancé, John Tagliabue of the New York Times, was later shot by a sniper when covering the fall of dictator Ceausescu in Romania. She recovered, he almost died, and then fell into a rabbit hole of paralyzing depression. So they returned to the place where they'd met, Italy, to the restorative power of food.
Greeting the people who sold us our food, talking with them about what looked best, were my daily attempts to live like other people, to live a normal life as I always had. The tomatoes and broccoli, the baby artichokes and spinach, the mozzarella and scallopini they sold me. Everything I carried home, cooked, served, then ate 3 times a day at the tiny oak table in our dining room, became my lifeline to normality. For even though John could not talk, he could eat, and the two of us, somehow, managed to eat most of our meals in a silence that was at least companionable.
Paula's memoir is called Keeping the Feast, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
This book is so many things. It's a love story. It's a memoir of depression. It's an insight into war journalism, but it's also an Epicurean delight. Food, as we just heard, sort of became your language, but also a language that you used to describe the divide that you saw when you went first from Italy to communist countries. Tell us about that abundance versus, what's the phrase, niema?
Niema. Niema means there is none. Rome and Italy was abundance when we lived there and still is. It's a place blessed by sun and good land, and so the vegetables and fruit that would grow there were just not only beautiful, but amazingly tasty.
Well, sort of this abundance, you know, becomes metaphor for your relationship when you and John first fall in love. There's an abundance of everything and hope and everything. And you even pack up food. I mean, the list of what you took with you to your war coverage, cases of spaghetti, spaghettini, arborio rice, Parmesan cheese, olives, jars of pesto. It's almost like you, if you could take some of that with you, it might protect you, but it didn't.
It didn't. The thing was that these were the tail end years of communism. Poland was a country that had very little in terms of things you could buy. When we arrived and you would walk into a supermarket, it was so hard to believe you were actually in the 1980s because it looked like it was still the 40s and the war was on. There would be empty shelves everywhere you looked.
Well, and you are covering this protest in Czechoslovakia. I'm actually on a website. We're going to link to it for our listeners with photographs from this, your story. And I'm looking at the place where you were beaten bloody. I mean, is that your blood on the wall?
It is.
This is a shrine to you that people left after you, this Western correspondent, you were beaten by the Czechoslovakian secret police.
Everywhere there was an incident, people put up candles and lay flowers for a week or so after. And it was terribly moving because someone, I never saw it when I was still there. Someone sent me the picture later.
And then shortly after that, John is shot by a sniper, a wound in his back as big as your forearm.
Yes, and it went from one side of his back to the other with a tunnel under his spine. His spine was like this little white bridge over this red meat. It was very... very disturbing.
And of course, you are in a communist country. They don't have antibiotics. You know, he almost dies. You both return, though, to Italy. And as your friends say, you return as two ghosts. He's a little ghostlier than you. You know, for people who think, oh, depression is sort of like, you know, a bad day, you are intimately connected with it. Your mother had it, and then now your husband. How bad was it?
It was distressingly bad. When you look at the person who you know, who you live with, who you've been with for years, and suddenly somebody else is there, some stranger with dead eyes, the person you know is simply not there.
He curled up in a fetal ball at times, sobbing.
Yes, he would bang his head against the wall or the bedpost. If a phone rang, it could set off paroxysms of fear, an anxiety attack. He was put on drugs, none of which worked. It turned out he did have drug-resistant depression. And the drugs would give him every side effect known to man, but nothing that would help the depression.
And here you are with this stranger, you know, in Europe trying to save your marriage. Meanwhile, the parallel story is your mom. And, you know, your mother had a very different kind of depression that we now know as postpartum depression. And how did hers show itself when you were growing up?
I have no memories of her sort of weeping in corners, but she was a very nervous person, and there was rage, and she didn't know how to deal with it, and she was a very private person. She never told me that she had had this illness until I was 28 years old.
But again, enter food, because your family always had food, and in ways that just, you know, enviable. I mean, I'm turning to the page that describes the Sunday lunch that you had virtually every Sunday of your life, all relatives gathering around. There was Jenny's pasta al ragu, meatball, sausage, chicken, pork, a mixed salad, good for the digestion, then dessert. There would be fresh blueberry, apple, cherry, pumpkin pie, Boston cream or lemon meringue. You also grew up eating fruit. You know, it seems as if your mother could give you love that way, and you were trying to do the same thing with your husband.
Absolutely. My mother, you know, had a lot of problems, but I never once doubted that I wasn't totally loved, and whether it came from the food or just general things, that was never an issue. But food, both in my family and in John's, it just was perfectly natural that two or three times a day the whole family would sit together, and it wasn't just eating. It wasn't just the food. It could have been anything. It didn't have to be Italian. Mealtime was a time of sharing what was going on in our lives.
Well, we mentioned, you know, food as a restorative power. And as you're right, it was too late. You know, something was too late for your mother. She seemed to have a relapse and committed suicide.
Yes. When John was shot, she hadn't met him yet. And his shooting sort of was the shock that triggered a relapse into depression. She had been cured every other time, the four earlier depressions she had. She had been cured with electroconvulsive therapy. And that had gone out of favor.
Yeah.
And so they treated her with drugs. The first few drugs they tried didn't work. Then they put her on something else that truly didn't work. And she was psychotic within a couple of weeks, and then she was dead.
Well, I'm sorry. And you say her psychosis might have been a paradoxical reaction to one of the drugs. But what about John? Did your love and the food and just that simple one foot in front of the other, three meals a day, is that what worked for him?
I personally think the food was a great help. Rome was a great help. The sunshine and heat of Italy was a great help. But basically what you're trying to do is when a person has depression, you can compare it to a fever. And this fever comes and goes. And while the fever is raging, the main thing to do is to keep the person from killing himself or herself. And food was our family's way of passing the time, helping those days go by. For families who food means nothing to, every family's got a way to make things work. And people should just find the thing that makes them happy or reminds them of happier things and focus on that, to use it as a crutch to get through these days until the fever passes.
That's Paula Bordarini. Her new book is Keeping the Feast, One Couple's Story of Love, Food, and Healing in Italy. And we'll link you to the beautiful pictures that help illustrate her story at our website, hereandnow.org. And John is well now?
John is very well. Very good. Well right now.
Good. Paula, thanks so much.
Thank you.